please reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. The court apologizes. We have made it a point for over a year to be precisely on time according to the clock in this courtroom. And sometimes only two or three of us came out, but we were out on time. So I apologize, but a matter has come up that needed our immediate attention. And your matter needs our immediate attention now, and we're prepared to give that to you. You'll notice that only six justices are sitting. Justice John Wilcox had surgery, and he's doing well, but he cannot be here today, and he will not be participating in this case or the other cases heard earlier. Excuse me. Okay. So, after I have conferred with Justice Babbage, I stand on my words. I'll call this case 01-1879 State v. Alan Radke. Appearing for Mr. Radke is William Schmall, Assistant State Public Defender.
Good afternoon. In this case, a question is raised about the constitutionality of the Wisconsin criminal statute that is popularly known as the two strikes and you are out law. Under this repeater penalty statute, the most severe penalty known to Wisconsin law, namely life imprisonment without the possibility of parole, must be imposed upon a person's second conviction from a group of crimes that are designated as serious child sex offenses. Here, Radke's two crimes were both Class B felonies, although the two strikes law would require the same penalty upon a person's second conviction of a Class D felony. My argument against the two strikes law this afternoon is straightforward, but the issue was somewhat novel to the courts, and in preparing for this oral argument, I discovered a couple of inaccuracies in my primary written brief, which may have added to the perplexity. In addition, I would like to caution the court at the outset that in discussing the issue that is raised here, it is easy to confuse the question of whether a crime is less serious than another crime with the question of whether a penalty, a criminal penalty, is less severe than another criminal penalty. For these potential areas of confusion, I anticipate that the court may have a number of questions for me. If it would be helpful, and if the court indulges me, I propose to spend the next 4 to 5 minutes of my time laying out each step of my legal reasoning one by one, and then devote the remainder of my time to answering questions. Of course, if the court chooses not to indulge me, that's understood.
Well, counsel, we generally give everybody free five, and generally don't ask questions, but I can't necessarily restrain myself or the other members of the court, but you have some time to present your case, and then we'll be free to ask you questions.
Here we go, then. The precise issue is whether the two strikes law, on its face, is arbitrary under either the Due Process Clause or the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. Insofar as the statute mandates that a more severe penalty shall be imposed upon a person's second conviction of less serious offenses, such as Radke's Class B felonies, then Wisconsin law would impose upon the second conviction of more serious offenses, such as Class A felonies, including first-degree intentional homicide. The penalty, by the way, for a second Class A felony offense is life imprisonment with the possibility of parole release at or after 20 years confinement in the circuit judge's discretion. And for purposes of convenience this afternoon, I will choose as the more serious offense that I use in my remarks, the offense of first-degree intentional homicide, because this court has described that offense, and I am referring to a case decision that is not cited in my brief, State versus Borrell, B as in Bravo, O-R-R-E-L-L, 167, Wisconsin 2nd at page 777. Reading verbatim, the court said, first-degree murder is the most serious of all crimes and well-deserving of the most severe punishment in Wisconsin, life imprisonment. I indicated that my argument was straightforward, and it is simply this, reduced to its very essence. Under the rational basis test, a less serious crime may be punished equally with a more serious crime, but it may not be punished more seriously. This is especially true where the less serious crime does not result in a death. And this rule applies to not just the first offense, but also repeat offenses. And I will explain how I reached this conclusion with two different modes of analysis. The first mode of analysis takes advantage of this court's previous decision in State versus As 4, which was cited in my written brief. The fundamental axiom of As 4 is this, that in general, it is arbitrary for the criminal statutes to subject a less serious crime to a more severe penalty than a more serious crime. The state has not asked the Supreme Court to overrule State versus As 4 in this case. Further, in general, we know from Wisconsin law that repeater penalty statutes do not alter the magnitude or the seriousness of the underlying crime. They only increase the maximum penalty. So I think the As 4 rule applies not just to a first offense of any particular crime, but also to a repeat offense, because the seriousness of the crime stays the same. Second.
What about the seriousness or risk of danger presented by the criminal? Doesn't that change when you get into the repeater statute?
I think it probably does, sure.
I mean, as I read your argument, it almost entirely is focused on this comparison of the seriousness of various crimes in the present classification system. And the repeater statutes focus not so much on the seriousness of the crime that has been committed, but on the dangerousness of the criminal or the risk of reoffending that the criminal presents. That's the whole point and purpose and thrust of repeater statutes.
If I understand you, we still have the fundamental problem from As 4 that it is arbitrary for a less serious crime to be punished more severely than a more serious crime. And I think we have to compare, in order for the comparison to be apt, we have to compare a second offense of the more serious, or whichever level of repeater you're talking about, with a second offense of the less serious. So I don't think it advances the analysis. And I'd be happy to address what the Court of Appeals ruled on the same point that you're reaching. Could I sidestep you for just a few minutes?
Well, sure, but that's, from my perspective, the main focus of this case is the comparison between repeaters, not comparing a repeater to a non-repeater.
I assure you that I will come back to this at great length. Okay. The first part of my As 4 syllogism was that it is arbitrary for less serious crimes to be punished more severely than more serious crimes, and that repeater penalty statutes do not alter the seriousness of the underlying crime. The second portion of that reasoning is that we know that the two strikes law crimes are less serious than first-degree intentional homicide, which is a Class A crime. We know that they are less serious for two reasons. First of all, the legislature itself has described both or most of those two strikes offenses as Class B or lesser class felonies. There is one exception to that. That is a Class A. But in addition, we know that for all of the two strikes offenses, including the one Class A, they are inherently less serious than first-degree intentional homicide because they do not result in death. And I take it as the second axiom of this Court's decision in State versus Asfor that crimes which result in death are inherently more serious than crimes which do not result in death, at least provided that the other aspects of the crime, the culpable conduct, is the same. Therefore, it follows, under the rules of Asfor, that the two strikes law is arbitrary because it mandates a more severe penalty, life without the possibility of parole, upon the conviction of a second Class B or lesser offense than is mandated upon the second conviction of Class A first-degree intentional homicide. There's another mode of analysis that I can add to this, though, and that is what we might call traditional due process analysis. And I agree to the rational basis test as being applied in this case. Under the rational basis test, a statute must have a legitimate public purpose, and the statute must be a rational method of accomplishing that public purpose. Well, here, I agree that the two-strike statute has a legitimate public purpose. It's to protect the public safety, and one can even say it's to protect children in particular. I also agree that the two-strikes law is a rational method in part of accomplishing that public purpose, because it does protect children by incapacitating repeat child sex offenders for life without parole. But the statute is also irrational in part, I submit, because it does not protect children by incapacitating repeat child murderers. Same kind of comparison that worked under the Asfor mode of analysis here. And therefore, I conclude or I suggest that a statute cannot be rational in part and irrational in part, and we still call it rational. I think it's got to be irrational. I note that this mode of analysis that I've just gone through, what I've called traditional due process, does contain an element of comparison between two different statutes. Why is that? Well, it isn't because I'm really offering an equal protection argument. The reason is because the assessment of rationality in penalty classifications is intrinsically a matter of relativity. In other words, a penalty cannot be accepted or rejected as fair or as arbitrary without considering its place relative to other penalties. That's what the Court did in State versus Asfor.
Wasn't that equal protection?
Well, the Court said it was equal protection. The two crimes at issue in Asfor was causing injury by negligent conduct and causing death by negligent conduct. And I sincerely believe that the category or the class of persons who cause injury by negligent conduct is not similarly situated with the class of people who cause death. And likewise, the category of people who commit Class B felonies is not similarly situated with the class who commit Class A felonies. But it makes no difference to me if the Court wishes to resolve this case on an equal protection basis.
Did the Asfor Court ask for trouble in using an equal protection analysis rather than due process?
I don't think so. I went and looked at the briefs that the parties filed in that case, and the briefs did not really address the equal protection analysis at all.
Let me more try the question, I'm sorry, in a better fashion. Did the Asfor Court erroneously employ an equal protection argument rather than make its finding based on a due process analysis.
Yes. In my opinion, it was erroneous to call it equal protection. It should have been called substantive due process.
Counsel, does it make any difference? Whether your argument is due process or your argument is equal protection, is the test not the same?
The test is the same for a rational basis, and I think arbitrariness is exactly what we were talking about under both tests. So as I say, I don't particularly care which mode of analysis the court uses. I just personally think it's due process. I want to come back to Justice Sykes' question, if I could, at this time. The question, as I understood it, was can't we justify the two-strike statute on the theory that a repeater statute, and please correct me if I'm misstating what you were asking, a repeater statute in effect changes the what started out as an ABC classification and somehow becomes more, instead of an analysis of an individual offense or crime committed in isolation, more of an analysis of the person's character. Okay. That's really what the Court of Appeals decision said, is that the legislature could have decided that people who commit a second child sex offense are more of a public threat than people who commit a second other kind of offense. They're more of a public threat in terms of recidivism, and therefore that would justify the statute. Well, if that's what Your Honor was asking me, here's my answer to that. And it has really two or three parts. First of all, I suggest sincerely that there really is no realistic basis. None appeared in the Court of Appeals decision and none appears in the state's brief to say that a person who has committed two murders at two different times, unconnected, because remember, the two-strike statute refers to a second offense occurring after a person had been previously convicted. So my first answer is that I don't think there's a realistic basis for this court to say that a person who has committed two separate murders at two separate times is any less likely to recidivate than someone.
Let me make that argument. You might have a serial killer. They're not unknown. And a serial killer will strike again and is by definition a recidivist. You might have a hired gun, that is, somebody who gets paid to kill, and that person, given enough money and hasn't learned the dangers of prison, will strike again. I accept that. And there may be other examples of that. But what we're dealing with is sexual assault on children, and we're dealing with pedophilia. So that's arguable anyway. On the nature of these statutes. And although it's not crystal clear, there seems to be a lot of evidence that pedophilia is a recurring event. It's hard to move people off it, that there is recidivism, and that although obviously killing is much more serious than being marred for life. At least you have an opportunity to recover if you're living. The concept, and I think Justice Sykes was trying to get to this point, the concept that you want to protect society from someone who is most likely to repeat, namely a child sex offender, is enough to give us a heavier sentence than to a murderer. That, I think, is what the Court of Appeals said. And what's the matter with that? There's a real strong appeal to me on that.
Well, I'm suggesting, first of all, factually, I'm not sure it is fair to say that a person who has committed two murders, unconnected, convicted of one, comes back and kills again.
Fair is not the issue. It doesn't you just have to have a rational basis? Doesn't the legislature have to have just a reason that's plausible here for doing this?
Well,
and that even if we think it's sort of silly and we wouldn't have voted for it, it's good enough to pass constitutional muster?
Well, in the Pepe's courtesy cab case, this court found that there isn't really a realistic basis to conclude that cab drivers with shaved faces will improve the city's image. But I don't want to get hung up on this. There's a more powerful answer that I can give you. Even assuming that what you've said is correct, that factually the legislature could have found that second-time child sex offenders are more likely to repeat than second-time murderers. The problem is we still have the rule in Wisconsin that a less serious crime cannot be punishable more severely than a more serious crime, and that the repeater statute does not change the magnitude of the less serious crime. As a result, what was a B when it started out, a B child sex offense, even with the repeater, is still a B, whereas the murder is an A.
That doesn't mean that a more serious criminal cannot be punished more seriously.
I'm not sure that I understand your distinction between the crime and the criminal. What State versus Asfor said is that a less serious crime, assuming that the crime was attached to the criminal, cannot be punishable more severely than a more serious
crime.
Right,
but that goes to the classification system, which is not at issue here. What's at issue is a statute that focuses on the likelihood of recidivism in the criminal. It doesn't focus on the nature or severity of the offense. It focuses on the risks and dangers that this particular type of criminal presents to society. In other words, a repeat sex offender, child sex offender.
Well, if I understand, Your Honor, you're ignoring settled Wisconsin law, which is that the repeater statutes do not alter the magnitude or seriousness of the crime at issue.
I'm not suggesting that they do. I'm not suggesting that they alter the magnitude or severity of the crime that was committed. They do not. What they do is they alter the evaluation of the rehabilitative potential of the criminal, which is the other axis, if you will, on the sentencing scale. Do you remember the old Wisconsin sentencing guidelines?
Certainly.
Those forms? Have you taken a look at the ones that have been prepared by the Criminal Penalty Study Committee for use while we're waiting for the Sentencing Commission to prepare new sentencing guidelines?
No.
Okay. Under the old sentencing guidelines, there were two axes, right? There was one that had to do with the severity of the offense, and based upon an evaluation of certain factors, the crime was plotted on that axis of the grid. And the other axis of the grid was an evaluation of the risk presented by the offender. And after a series of evaluations that the person who fills out the form would go through based on the prior record of the offender, the defendant would be plotted on that risk factor axis of the grid. So that while there are three sentencing factors, severity of the crime, the character of the offender, and the interest of the public or community, there are basically two main areas of inquiry in any sentencing decision. One, what's the severity of this offense? And two, what kind of offender do I have here in terms of risk to reoffend? And this statute, the repeater statute as a whole, and this statute, the two strikes for child sex offenders in particular, focuses on that second axis about the risk that these sorts of offenders pose. It has nothing to do with the severity of the offense.
Well, if I understand you, what you're suggesting is the legislature should have reclassified the child sex offenses as something other than Class B, or they should have rescinded the rule that repeater statutes don't change the magnitude of the crime. My point is that once the legislature has classified child sex crimes for the most part as B and less, or once the courts have decided that a non-homicide crime is inherently less serious than a homicide crime, we have the rule of State versus Asfor to account for that the less serious crime cannot be punishable more severely than the more serious crime.
But it can be if it's committed by a repeat offender without violating equal protection or substantive due process.
Perhaps then I just don't understand what you're suggesting.
Could
I ask Mr. Schmall?
Yes, sir.
Why is there no argument here about cruel and unusual punishment?
Don't misunderstand me, sir. Although my argument is built upon due process, I believe this statute has substantial cruel and unusual punishment problems. Namely, the first time somebody gets convicted of two Class D felony offenses or even two Class C felony offenses and gets life without parole, I will be back in here arguing that that's cruel and unusual. But in this case, I'm arguing that it is not rational to penalize Mr. Radke more severely for a second Class B than he would be subject to for a second Class A.
Well, there's a case pending in the United States Supreme Court, isn't there, on three strikes? I think it was a California three strikes. Is that going to have any effect on this case?
I'm not familiar with that case other than that I believe it's a cruel and unusual punishment issue.
Okay.
It just seems to me you're going to attack the legislature's work product. There is a clause in the Constitution that really goes right to that the punishment for certain conduct is cruel and unusual. Here, it seems to me you're not focusing on the punishment for these multiple offenses per se. You're looking at them in relation to certain other things. And it seems to me our job is to say, is there any rational basis for the legislature to have done that? There are rules and there are exceptions to rules. And this may be an exception to a rule that's related to the ABC, what have you.
I'm not sure if there was a question there at the end.
Well, you can come back and punch back.
My point to repeat is
that's what you're saying.
That if the purpose... I'm sorry, I just ran out of time.
You may answer the question. Or punch back, whichever you prefer.
If we say that the purpose of this statute, the two-strike statute, is to protect the public safety, in particular children, and if we say that, yes, it does that in part by incapacitating child sex offenders, but does not do it by incapacitating child murderers, is that a rational basis? I submit it's not. That's the best answer I can give you, I guess. Thank you.
Your brief says that the result might be that people think it's better to kill the child than to leave it alive, because if you kill, you have two shots. You're not going to get no parole until the third, whereas if it's just a sexual assault, you only have two shots before you get no parole.
I'd just like to say that my argument in the Supreme Court is founded on the logical and legal reasoning, not upon what the Court of Appeals rejected, which was my suggestion that, yes, this might encourage child molesters to kill children.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Novak, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Sandy Nowak. Enough. We've had enough. In passing this statute essentially through their legislators, that's what the people of the state of Wisconsin said. The point at which an individual sexually assaults two children is the point at which we draw the line. And we're not going to place another child or give him the opportunity to have another child become his third strike. There's nothing arbitrary or irrational about that statute. Whether you or I disagree with it, whether or not it could be the subject of political debate is not at issue before the court today. What is at issue is solely, is this a rational response to this particular problem?
Is the issue a bit more nuanced? Not just whether or not this is a rational or reasonable response to the problem, but whether or not it's reasonable to penalize someone based on this offense vis-a-vis the repeat offender for Class A example. I mean, isn't it in comparison that we are viewing the rationality or the reasonableness and not in isolation?
I think that's what Mr. Radke would like you to do, but I think what he has presented in essence are three constitutional elements of three constitutional claims, and he can't succeed on any one of them, and so they're kind of merged together in a mucky kind of way. Because when what you're talking about is proportionality, which goes to Justice Prosser's question, and the reason I think, if I were defending Mr. Radke, that I would not bring a proportionality question here, first of all, the law is unclear, but secondly, I don't know that we could ever say that when an offender has sexually assaulted two children and he rapes a 4-year-old over a period starting at 4 to 6, that I don't think that we can say that it is grossly disproportionate to incapacitate him. Again, we may not agree with it, but I don't think he could succeed on that claim.
My question in total is based on the discussion we asked for, and it concludes, if there is any reasonable basis for penalizing one who causes death, by negligent use of a weapon as a misdemeanor, while penalizing one who causes injury by negligent use of a weapon as a felony, this court would sustain the classification. So that's the way they set the question up, not in isolation, not whether this is reasonable, but whether or not it's reasonable vis-a-vis the other. Is it more reasonable? Is it reasonable? Is there any reasonable basis for classifying negligent use of a weapon that causes death as a misdemeanor and negligent use of a weapon that causes injury as a felony? And that's the way they set up the analysis. Maybe they're wrong.
Well,
maybe that's a muck, too.
In that situation, they weren't wrong, because I think there you were talking essentially about lesser included offenses. We're talking about then truly, I think, as Mr. Schmall sort of views this, as a more linear approach. That is, you've done X, the more advanced, exaggerated version of that same act is essentially a lesser included offense. In this case, and maybe if I approach it a different way, not to sidestep your question, please feel free to interrupt me if I'm not answering your question, but I think one of the issues we can't forget is that the legislature, in enacting laws, is dealing with issues as they see them in society and fixing those issues as they see them. Part of the reason that this subclass of persistent repeaters may have been identified is because trial courts were doing perfectly fine in exercising their discretion in sentencing murderers, for example. And maybe part of the reason that we selected out this subset of persistent repeaters for child sex offenses is because the citizens weren't seeing the kind of penalties that they wanted for those particular kind of offenses.
I'd like to follow up on exactly what you're saying. Why wasn't the sexual predator law satisfactory?
Because they address two different issues. The sexual predator law, as I know this court is fully aware, is about mental commitment. Not all people who repeatedly victimize children in a sexual way are suitable for commitment under Chapter 980. And, in fact, a very small portion, even now with the law up and running, very small portion of the people who are potentially suitable for commitment are even make it through the first screening level because they don't meet the statutory criteria. And there's nothing wrong with the legislature looking at a multifaceted problem like this and laying out multifaceted sort of responses. It would be akin to saying, well, someone must be maybe a subset of people who kill might have mental health problems, but unless they meet the criterion for another mental health commitment, it's not going to change what their penalty should be for the criminal act unless they're relieved of mental responsibility. So they're really two different worlds, two different universes, I think.
What was the legislature's primary concern? Was it a future repetition of these crimes, or was it punishment?
I don't know for certain. I do know that there is evidence of both. That evidence, and I think what Justice Sykes was talking about before in terms of where the repetition of behaviors fits in, when we get to sentencing, we weigh out the factors, the gravity of the offense, the character of the offender, and all those factors you're familiar with. I think what the legislature has done here is taken from the trial court's discretion that's part of the subset of the sentencing factors that goes to character. That in this instance, they're saying with these offenders, the character is such that that they've demonstrated a propensity to commit these crimes. And it goes both ways in terms of the justifying an aggravated punishment because you didn't learn your lesson. In spite of being given opportunities to see the gravity of your offense, you chose to recommit it, but also then the very real need to protect the public, and that is evidenced by the statements of Representative Green that were quoted by the Court of Appeals, recognizing, for example, one study that said that the average pedophile or sex offender who victimizes children, because they are different, has over the course of a lifetime 300 victims, and that they are the most likely to recidivate. Those were two statements that the legislator made, which would suggest that they were concerned about protection of the community.
Now, you agree, I would think, that a Class A felony is more serious than a Class B felony.
I would agree with qualifications, because I think one of the things that we're forgetting here is that whole ABC system of classification gives a range, a guideline to courts, but they overlap, first of all.
So I could commit a Class A felony, or let's say I commit a Class B felony, and somebody else commits a Class BC felony. Class B felony has a higher punishment range. Class BC felony has a lower maximum. But the person who commits the B might get probation. The person who commits a BC might get 10 years, or whatever the maximum is, right?
Yes.
So the person who committed the greater felony, the B person, gets less of a sentence than the person who committed the lesser felony, BC. And that's possible under this system.
Right. And completely rational, because of the different things that people do to one another that take the discretion of circuit court to figure out how to deal with this. I mean, that's the necessary approach to dealing with human beings.
Well, now let's go to the repeater statute. The punishment for a second offense that falls within that sex offenses is what?
For the second offense of it's life imprisonment without the possibility of parole.
Does the judge have discretion about giving life imprisonment?
No.
Does the judge have any discretion about without parole or with parole?
No.
No. So the discretion is taken out.
From
the judge, because the court has, the legislature has determined as a matter of law that a second offense deserves this punishment. And if we didn't have a problem as to what the punishment was for repeater Class A, there'd be no case here. I mean, there isn't a flat-out demand here that this punishment, this is the cruel and inhuman treatment. This is not that man. Okay. So where does that get us? What does the jury have to decide under this repeater?
Nothing. It's not a jury question.
So all they have to do is bring in the conviction of the prior offense.
Well, and the prosecutor has to exercise their quasi-judicial judgment about which to bring.
Do that, and that's okay under Apprendi, so we don't have a problem.
Right.
Okay. So isn't the state's position, in essence, that the classifications, A through whatever, doesn't come into play here on serious or less serious with a repeater? Because, as Justice Sykes would say, the legislature has made a legislative decision about the risk factor, the risk presented by the offender.
That's correct.
In that the strongest point, which I think is instantly catching, frankly, that how can you punish a Class B offender who commits two offenses, life without parole, and yet a Class A offender who commits two Class A offenders still has the possibility of life with parole?
Well,
I mean, it just doesn't seem right, okay?
That is a little fuzzy, the language there as well, because the trial court has the discretion of sentencing someone to life without the possibility of parole in their lifetime, certainly under State v. Sedegar. And so even though the possibility that the trial court may choose to exercise their discretion to deny parole, on a facial attack on this statute by substantive due process, he has to establish that there are no circumstances under which the statute is constitutional. Today, a judge could sentence a Class A offender on a second offense to a sentence of life without the possibility of parole.
The judge can do that on the first offense.
That's correct. And so at that point, his argument is completely gutted because that creates a set of circumstances under which the remedy he seeks is essentially being given.
And that law, the life means life law, predated this child sex offender persistent repeater law.
That's correct.
And so we can assume that the legislature already knew it had taken care of the problem of potential repeat murderers by enacting the life means life law, and that they didn't need to pay any more attention to that problem, and they turned their attention to this problem.
That's correct.
Well, sure. The judge would have the ability on the first Class A or the second Class A to say, you're in there for life without parole, without possibility of parole. But if you just look at the face of the statute, on one face, the judge has no discretion. Two strikes and you're out. On the second, if you look at the Class A, you say, three strikes and you're out. And yet B is a lesser offense. Two Bs are two lesser offenses, and I don't mean lesser included, but lesser offenses, than each of the three As, Class A. So if you just look at it on the face and say, what is the lesser penalty here, or potential penalty, I think you have to say, boy, you got a shot with the judge on one and two for Class A, but you ain't got no shot with the judge on a second Class B. And therefore, you've got the as-for circumstance where the less serious crime is punished or punishable, not punished, but punishable with a more serious penalty than the less serious offense. And you have to accept B is less serious than A, because that's what the legislature said.
But I think you have to also, to do that, you have to put your blinders on in so many directions in terms of that it loses all rationality. And there's no constant, even though it's sort of on this fuzzy something about it doesn't feel right, there's no constitutional requirement at all for proportionality between different offenses committed by people in different situations, first of all. Secondly, there's no requirement for proportionality between the underlying felony classification and the recidivist punishment. So, for example, even within its own recidivist category, there's no requirement that there be any correlation between the underlying felony classification and the punishment that they ultimately get. It doesn't make sense, then, to suggest that with two different recidivist statutes, which, by the way, have different potential objectives, I believe, that there would have to be some sort of internal correlation there. There's just not a constitutional requirement for that, and it is because the legislature has to deal with the social problems that they see in their state at the time and as they've identified as having the priorities. And I alluded to it, that I think you can see a basic difference between the purpose of the two and the three strikes provisions, and actually the two-strike statute can be actually viewed, I think, as viewing giving people an opportunity to change. So, for example, if what we've said here is that sex offenders who commit their crimes against children have a very high rate of recidivism, higher than the other crimes, and if we then say to them ahead of time, giving them notice, on a second offense, you are going to be imprisoned for life without the possibility of parole, if our objective is to avoid the commission of that second crime altogether, would that be not be more effective than saying to him, you'll have a third opportunity, or a second opportunity? So it's a, and when we're looking at the offenders who've committed those two-strike offenses, they're not, it's not their general criminality that we're targeting. It's their choice to repeat a particular offense. And that is a different issue than the person. I think the three-strike statutes around the country were enacted in part to get at a relatively small proportion of offenders who committed a larger number of offenses. That's a different objective than targeting the offender who chooses to recidivate in a particular way.
Is it your position that the legislature has made a legislative determination as to the risk of this type of offender? I mean, and that they have determined that the risk of a offender, sexual abuse offender, repeat offender, is riskier than a repeat murderer?
The comments from Representative Green would seem to indicate so, yes.
Let me ask if that's reasonable, using the ASFOR test. And I say this more anecdotally, you know, no citations here. I believe that there, and I've seen murderers that I think present very little threat to the public. He may have presented a heck of a big threat to his wife and he killed her, or vice versa, she presented a heck of a big threat to him and she killed him. But as to the public, that murderer presents no threat. So I can say that I think repeat child sex offenders present a heck of a lot more of a risk to the public than Jerry Fusek, that murdered his wife Joyce. But I see life differently if you're talking about a multiple murderer. That someone that who's already been convicted of murder and then murders again on a separate later occasion. Let me ask, is it rational, is it reasonable to say that a multiple child sex offender is more serious than a multiple murderer?
And I guess I'm not willing to concede that the issue is more serious or less serious. The issue is worthy of more punishment or less
punishment. Okay, fine. Let me use your words because you're right. I'm not talking about the crime. Is a multiple child sex offender worthy, present a greater risk, because that's the language we talked about earlier, because repeater a statute is a legislative determination as to risk. Is it rational for the legislature to determine that a repeat child sexual offender presents more risk to the public than a multiple murderer? Is that rational?
What they have done by virtue of this statute They have not said, we want these offenders to get greater penalties than the person who repeats homicides. Because let us not forget that when someone repeats a homicide, they are subject to two life sentences without the possibility of parole. What the legislature has done here was merely to say that we're taking the discretion away from the trial court so that you know for sure at the point at which you have victimized a second child, you will not have another chance. And so it really is like comparing apples and oranges. This isn't a matter of what the appropriate sentence ultimately should be necessarily. It's about what the legislature wants to be sure about. And I think that the three strikes law does not just target people who commit three homicides. They might have a burglary, a sexual assault, and a homicide. They might have three completely different crimes. I think many courts, if someone is facing a second conviction or sentencing on a second conviction for homicide, I'm guessing in most courts we don't need to worry about the length of the sentence there. With child sexual assaults, as we've seen, when you look at some of these old sexual assault cases that had come back time and time again, the early sentences were inappropriately short, and I think that is what this statute is getting at. Like, no more. We're done. You don't get a third strike when it involves a child.
I thought that your response to Justice Bradley might be that, and tell me if you agree with this or not, that just because the legislature has not addressed the problem of multiple murderers does not mean that they can't address the problem of multiple pedophiles.
That's correct. That is correct.
What's the penalty for homicide, intentional homicide?
Life imprisonment.
Period. No, that's mandatory.
It's life imprisonment. At this point, it's life imprisonment, and the trial court can give a set of a parole eligibility date or indicate that there will not be a parole eligibility date.
Let me get back to my point for just a second. I can't put my fingers on the cases that have essentially said that, but you must be able to give me some that...
State v. Black would be the beginning, and then I believe you also cited that's State v. Black in State v. Hahn.
Okay.
Certainly State v. Post talks
what
about
point,
that.
What point are you citing these cases for? Just tell me the point.
For the proposition that the legislature can, just because the legislature chooses to attack one particular
right.
problem,
mm-hmm.
doesn't mean that they're wrong in, or chooses not to address, or chooses to parse out how they're addressing the problem, does not mean that.
Need to address the whole problem.
Right. And State v. Post, I think, does an excellent job at looking at that, where the claim was you could apply this more broadly. And I think that's another one of the problems with Mr. Radke.
They did address the problem. They enacted a two-strike for certain offenses and a three-strike for another offenses. So if they hadn't done – so they addressed repeat offenses for a list of felonies, not all felonies, right?
Right.
So they did address the problem. What a problem didn't they address here? I mean, if we're going to apply the legislature can attack one issue, needn't address all of it. What problem didn't they address?
Well, I think you could read Mr. Radke's argument to say that murderers should only get two strikes.
Well, that's the equal protection or due process or whatever, or ask for argument. But they seem to have covered the repeater.
I'm not sure what you
think. They seem to have covered the totality of the repeater. I suppose there are some felonies that don't fit under this. Larceny, is it the theft fits under this repeater? Three strikes?
And some thefts do, I would have to look at.
So that's not all thefts, so they don't cover that whole waterfront. What's your strongest argument?
That it is not irrational to incapacitate a repeat offender to prevent him from further victimizing children when your objective is to protect children, and particularly when the offenders have notice of it to begin with. There's just no constitutional ground.
Particularly when the defender's what?
Has notice of it to begin with. You know, this is public law. We're telling you, if you choose to commit another offense, the penalty is life without possibility of parole. If in the face of that consequence they commit another offense. I think that tells us something about the degree of motivation and the likelihood that they would have, in fact, recidivated beyond the second offense. Moreover, I just think it is within the province of the legislature to make these very difficult decisions. And certainly, in any courtroom in this state, the point at which someone is sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole should be taken seriously. It's a momentous occasion. But similarly momentous and similarly painful and difficult for the society is the point at which an adult male rapes a 4-year-old or a 6-year-old, and it's not his first victim.
Does the prosecutor have a choice of whether to charge under this statute or waive charging under this statute?
Yes, they do. Because it is just a subclass of the other repeater statute, 93962, and then if you look at 97312, which specifies out how it must be pled, it's clear that the prosecutor has discretion. Thank you.
I just have another question for you. Is there any... I've read the Court of Appeals decision, I'm sure you have, and it's in your favor, ultimately. If I have a chance to write it, or one of the justices is going to write this and decide it in your favor, could we just accept this opinion as ours? Would you want it strengthened in any way, or weakened in any way, or changed in any way? Sometimes you win, but there are a few sentences in here that
nothing that comes to mind at this point, but, you know, I could send you an email. No, I really, I'm sorry, nothing at this point. I think the point is that the Court of Appeals recognized that it doesn't matter what you call it. This statute is a rational response to a very serious problem in this state, and that it is the province of the legislature, even though it's the subject of potential debate and has been the subject of the debate. The proper place for that was exactly where it happened, which was in the democratic election system.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Schmall? I'm not sure I understood, counsel, your introductory statement about you thought that your brief did not quite set the issue properly, or that you're doing some changing here.
I meant to convey that there are some inaccuracies that I discovered in my brief. If I can correct those very quickly, if you'd like me to, or alert you to.
Are they substantive or just?
At one point, page 16 of the appellant's brief, I indicated that one legitimate purpose of the two-strike statute is to protect children from becoming the victims of sexual assaults.
Okay.
I think that's inaccurate because three of the crimes that are in the two strikes catalog do not have any component of sexual assault. Enticement is defined solely in terms of getting the child away from the protection of the general population. Child abduction and kidnapping. Those three crimes are all in the two strikes catalog and do not contain any element of sexual assault. So I think to be accurate, what we have to say is the purpose of the two strike statute is to protect children from persistent repeaters generally. At another point in the petitioner's brief, the remedies, and this is important, I indicated that what the legislature can do if it wants to fix this problem would be to either combine the two strikes crimes into the three strikes category, and that's fine, I don't change that, or they could add the three strikes crimes into the two strikes category, that's fine, I don't change that. But the error I made was in suggesting that the two strikes crimes could be reclassified as Class A felonies or as some sort of super Class A felony. That doesn't work. That's wrong, because then what you would have is what are inherently less serious non-homicide crimes being treated more severely than the most serious crime in Wisconsin, which is first-degree murder. I have a couple of random points in rebuttal. I'm sorry. I don't know of any good way to organize these. Number one, you can't really say that the legislature can address part of the problem at a time, and then a two-strike statute, it's addressed the problem of persistent child sex offenders, and it can come back to persistent murderers later, because that isn't true. The legislature already has addressed the problem of persistent murderers in the three-strike statute. And the three-strike statute includes many of the same crimes that are already listed in the two-strikes catalog. On this question of, will some crimes have a range of penalties, and does that somehow save the statute, the fact that the district attorney has discretion, I'm sorry, in my opinion, that doesn't work either. You can't say that a statute that on its face appears to be irrational, if you accept my argument, can be saved if we trust the trial courts to do it right at sentencing, or if we trust the prosecutors to choose when to charge it. No, I think our constitutional rights stand upon more solid ground than that. And by the way, the two strikes law doesn't even have a penalty range. It's a mandatory life without parole, period. Can we say, and I'm coming back to Justice Sykes, I hope a little bit, that Class ABC is good for one purpose, but when we talk about recidivists, we're talking about something else. I suggest not. Can a school teacher say to the children that the number one is defined as less than the number two for purposes of magnitude, but for purposes of addition, 1 + 1 is greater than 2 + 2? No, that's my point. That's not rational.
Sentencing is not a mathematical calculation.
I agree, but I think this is so elementary that it really can't be thrust aside. I do believe that the ABC classification that we start with has the element of character built into it, as well as recidivism. And I don't think we can honestly say that the character of a person who commits one murder and gets convicted and comes back and commits another one, that that person's character is somehow better than the character of a person who does the same thing with child sexual offenses.
Well, there may be very good arguments for including murderers in the two strikes law along with child sex offenders, but just because the legislature didn't do it or hasn't yet done it doesn't make the child sex offender two strikes law irrational.
I suggest that it does, and that the remedy here, my time is up, but if I can just say this, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
This whole thing could have been solved, and we wouldn't be here if the legislature had just said these serious child sex offenses either go into the three strikes catalog or everything. All of the persistent repeaters go into the two strikes catalog so that the penalties are equal rather than the Class B's and lesser being more severe than the Class A's. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Small. Thank you, Ms. Nowak, and for your arguments today on this interesting case. And that concludes our arguments on 01-1879 State v. Radke. We are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45.
Good to meet you.
You too.